Good morning. My name is Lars Hansen. I'm with the Technical University of Copenhagen. I'm here to chair this morning's session on reproducibility and fMRI. We have three presentations, very global, Pauline and Lucas Brother speaking. We have 3 hours, so it should be relatively easy. Let me introduce the first speaker, Gary Glover from Stanford University, professor of radiology, going to speak about conservations in multi-site fMRI.
Okay, thank you, Lars, and thanks to the organizers for inviting me here. It's really a quite a pleasant place to be, and certainly a useful place for people to think about functional imaging. So, okay. So, multi-site fMRI. So here's a laundry list of what I'm going to talk about. And first I'll try to tell you a little bit about why you might want to be interested in multi-center imaging studies. Recently, there's been a potential, a great interest in the potential use of MRI and fMRI, particularly as biomarkers, and pharmaceuticals and a whole lot of people are very interested in the possibility that non-invasive imaging can be used to detect and control for various kinds of diseases and for pharmacological interventions and so on. So structural and functional differences may predict disease, but a large study numbers are really necessary in order to prove those hypotheses because of biodiversity. So, for example, the Alzheimer's Disease Neuroimaging Initiative, using basically structural imaging techniques, a study recently by B.J. Casey investigating Alzheimer's attention deficit hyperdisorder. Disease. So what you need to do is generate a lot of data sets as quickly as possible in order to avoid various other confounds. As things drag on, various other things can come into play. So in order to affect these kind of studies, you need to grab a lot of data, and so doing that at a distributed set of sites might be useful. Also, you may be able to access a wider or even a targeted demographic more readily in a multi-site trial, and you can generate a lot of data that can be useful for other reasons than that which is originally funded for. So there are a number of reasons why you might want to do that. And I'm going to talk within the context of the FBURN, which is a large study supported by the NCRR. This is a series of the sites in this BIRN, the Biomedical Imaging Research Network. And so a number of these sites are involved in either a mouse BIRN, a morphology BIRN, or a functional BIRN, an FBIRN. The FBIRN that we'll talk about here, the goals are to develop multi-site fMRI methods, a federated database that can be accessed by any of the sites within the network, as an add-on to study schizophrenia. The methods, and I'm going to talk about a phase one study that was part of this multi-center trial. 5 normal controls were sent to 10 sites, a sensory motor, a breath hold, a resting state task, and a couple of schizophrenia-related tasks were performed during this study of traveling subjects. We had, interestingly, 3 vendors and both 1.5T and 3T, and our thought was that could we control for all of these variables within the site, and that was basically where we started. All right, so there are some issues in doing studies even at one site, but it gets magnified when you go to multi-center sorts of venues. The desire to unambiguously be able to pool results across sites requires all kinds of standardization. Different vendors, and one of the problems is that different vendors have different definitions of the same kinds of concepts. And so, for example, a pulse sequence contrast in the GE's 3D FSPGR can be very different than NP-RAGE, and trying to get those things coordinated across sites can be complicated. The meaning of bandwidth and echo spacing changes across vendors. And so if you specify a bandwidth of something hertz per pixel across in one vendor, it will mean something different in another vendor, and that'll have ramifications. So you in particular on artifacts and signal noise ratio and other things. Different vendors will have different ways of reconstructing the data. Their appetization filters can change the smoothness, the contrast noise ratio. So it isn't straightforward to just simply assume that you can specify the field of view and the number of voxels in your matrix and get the same resolution. Different vendors have different gradient distortion corrections, and that may have some ramifications on geometric accuracy. Calibration precision can be different. Temporal stability means different things to Siemens and GE, for example. Okay. So once you're starting a study like this, you need to qualify sites for entry into that study, and you need to first develop the characteristics for acceptance. What is it that you care about in a scanner? So, for example, some of these things are important. Geometric accuracy is less important in fMRI than it might be in a structural analysis, but it's still kind of important, and all of these other things. And I'm going to talk a little bit about some of these. You need to understand the sensitivity of scanner characteristics relative to these processes and how they can affect things if they are different, and how you might correct for these things across different scanners or make them behave in the ways that you want. And so you ultimately need to set some criteria that say you must be within this amount of something in order for your scanner to be qualified for this site. And so you need to maintain those minimum performance standards, which means you have to develop a QA program over the life of this study, which can be 3 or 5 years or whatever, depending on how much money you can nab out of the NIH or wherever. So you also need to define what you're going to do when your scanner is upgraded. And it's a fact of life that every several years you'll have either a software or maybe a hardware as well as software change in at least one of your sites in a study as large as FBurn, which is 10 sites, or ADNI, which is 70 or 80 sites. So what do you do when somebody changes their software? Do you need to requalify them or whatever? And in fact, you do. You need to control and or reduce side effects that result from imperfections and uncontrolled things that are beyond your control in all of these. And we'll talk about some of these. You need to reduce data acquisition confounds. For example, hemodynamics. And we touched briefly on that last night, and I'll spend another couple minutes on that today. Okay, so first thing is, how do you standardize protocols across these multiple sites? And all of this has to do, ultimately, with the reliability of your data. And I'm not going to talk about the mathematics of the reliability so much as the mechanistic aspects of how you try to get things as clean as possible beforehand. So the standardization includes acquisition, characteristics of scanners, how you perform the study at a given site. Certainly important, but I won't spend much time on, is the analysis pipeline and how you handle these massive quantities of data in ways that are reliable across different sites, so that if you have a database that contains all of the data, you have all the information you need in that database, so that you know where the data came from and that it's uniformly inserted. Of modest importance in an fMRI, and I'm going to spend all my time on fMRI here today, of modest importance are structural accuracy, because fMRI is such a wimpy resolution anyway. But you do care about it, and you do care about the structural image and contrast uniformly, but again, not as much as you would if you're doing a structural VBM-based analysis. Still, both of these characteristics have to be adequate, because you're going to do tissue segmentation to define gray matter and white matter masks. You're going to normalize people to a template, because, in fact, you ultimately care about grouped statistics. So you have to have at least good enough uniformity across sites so that this is very reliable. Okay. Things that are important, of course, are the fMRI acquisition, and one of those things is contrast and or smoothness. So you control the parameters. You, of course, want to maintain field of view and matrix size perfectly identical across sites and scanners, but it turns out that the measured smoothness, that is the size of a resolution element or resol, is in fact maybe not equal to field of view divided by matrix size, that is the pixel size. So it's not enough to say I want a 64 by 64 because when you do that, you find that here's the resolution that you should get for a 64 by 64 with a field of view of 220 millimeters, but across 10 sites, when we started, we ended up with some sites that were below, had better resolution, and most sites had worse resolution than the pixel size, and that's because of confounds in the reconstruction and other aspects of the way that these scanners take their data and utilize it. So one of those reasons for smoothness difference is that the reconstruction kernel can be different across vendors and across across different pulse sequences within a site. Siemens gathers K-space in a square matrix like this, as does GE, but Siemens doesn't use, for example, an apodization filter by default, although you can have one. GE, on the other hand, uses a round apodization filter, and in fact it's not a straight cutoff, it has some roll-off. So there's a resolution difference between these that will result in a smoother image in this this kind of a K-space acquisition and reconstruction than in this one. Well, other things that are important are the duration of the readout, which again, if your bandwidth isn't controlled and the readout differences are different enough, the acquisition time will affect the contrast as well as the signal noise ratio. T2 star will be different at 1.52 and 3T, and that will apodize the K-space acquisition as well. So a number of things can cause smoothness differences that will demonstrate that, for example, at higher field. And so, let's see, these are higher field, I guess, in white. Now, the white is GE, and black is Siemens, and this is Picker. So there are different differences here, but there's also differences from 1.5T to 3T. Okay, so other things that you want to keep constant are not the bandwidth necessarily, but the echo spacing, because that will control the duration of the readout and some other things that are useful. Slice spacing and this slice skip and the orientation can be different. You can specify that you want a 4 millimeter slice, but in fact, one vendor's slice thickness is 40% larger than 4 millimeters or 3 millimeters or whatever you specify. Just because their RF pulse design is a different philosophy, and what they call slice thickness has a different full width half max than another vendor. So those kinds of things can affect signal noise ratio as well as details that you might find kind of subtle but important. Whether you do fat saturation or you do water excitation makes a difference also in the slice profile, and different vendors have different default settings in their pulse sequence. Getting rid of the fat is important because it is 3.5 parts per million off resonance and causes artifacts if you don't. And I already mentioned the readout trajectory. For example, echoplanar versus spiral can affect the smoothness and artifacts. And so an echoplanar trajectory gathers K-space data in a fashion like this. Spiral starts at the origin and moves outward. Well, again, the resolution will be different between these because the corners of K-space are not collected in echoplanar. This is more efficient because a couple of gradients are contributing to the power and so on. So there's vast differences between these trajectories, even though nominally they both reconstruct 64 by 64. But the artifacts are different, and the smoothness and resolution will be somewhat different. So when we started in our FBIRN consortium, we had both echoplanar and spiral, and there was a difference that we found to our surprise. Field strength affects the signal noise ratio, the contrast noise ratio for bold, but it also affects things like the vessel-to-tissue conspicuity and what contributions there are, as, of course, does it affect artifacts. So that turns out to be important, and we decided after a couple of years into this that in fact it was pretty hard to control for that across 1.5T and 3T. So in later stages we eliminated the 1.5T scanners from the consortium. So here's in particular field strength and vendor differences in, again, smoothness. And smoothness here was defined as the full width half max of the the noise autocorrelation function after doing some processing. So there was a difference between high field and low field, and we think that's because of T2 star differences. There was a difference between GE and Siemens, and that's because of the reconstruction differences. And there were differences between GE and Siemens and low field and high field that resulted from different philosophies that were not understood or controlled for when we started in this business. Well, another thing that's very important besides all of those things, which you would think are pretty simple, I want a field of view of this and a resolution of this, go get me that. And all of those things were very complicated. But there's also more subtle things, such as dynamic image stability. Both fMRI and arterial spin labeling kinds of techniques are dependent on subtraction, and so you really care about scanner stability. It must be smaller, or even very much smaller, than the noise itself in the brain due to basal metabolic processes as well as other things. And so it's important to measure this and control for it. So here's an fMRI scan on a phantom, 200 time frames, and this one shows image-to-image RMS stability after detrending of about 0.09%. And it turned out we decided that about 0.1% was a max that we wanted to allow. So this scanner is in pretty good agreement. There's a fair amount of drift here, minus 1% over the life of this 8-minute scan. That turned out to be less interesting or less important to us, but also something that we cared about. So when we looked at, so where does this have to be? What kind of noise on a phantom do you care about? Well, it depends on brain noise, because if you look at the total noise in your fMRI acquisition, you have some thermal component, and you have a system level component, and you have some physiological noise that is due to the brain itself, both cardiac and respiration noise as well as basal metabolic bold related signals. And what you'd like is for the standard deviation of your thermal noise to be small compared to the physiological noise, and you would like the noise of your system to be small as well, so that really what you're looking at is noise that is dominated by the brain and not by your instruments. And so these things are proportional to the signal intensity, and you can modulate that by changing the flip angle if you want to characterize it. And so Doug Grieve and others of us in the FBurn developed a technique in which you acquire data at a couple of different flip angles. You can look at then the fraction of the scanner and brain noise if you use both human and phantom scans. And so here's a demonstration of the change in brain noise relative to thermal noise in white matter, in cortex in general, and different cortical structures, including caudate and amygdala and so on, for different sites in this case, five sites within the consortium. And you see vast differences across vendors or across sites, even in one region of the brain. And sort of one here is where you would like brain noise to be bigger than. And so in some cases, the brain noise is in fact larger than the thermal noise. In other cases, the thermal noise is, or system noise is larger than that of the brain, and that's not good. So you really want to set some kind of a threshold here in which the brain noise usually dominates that of the system. Okay, so we were able then to set some standards for that. And once you set those standards, then you have to do some quality assurance on an initial as well as an ongoing basis. So what to measure in a QA program? Well, you certainly care about image stability. That's really critical for fMRI, but you also care about a bunch of other things. And so some of these are important to measure at least once, and some are important to measure a lot of times, such as every time you do an fMRI study that you want to enter into this, or at least on a perhaps weekly basis. So for stability, we acquire data on a phantom using a typical fMRI acquisition. We try to stress the system equally or at least equally to that of the typical fMRI acquisition. And we do a number of different kinds of analyses on these data in an automated fashion. So you care about signal noise ratio and so on. So you take the time series and you detrend it. You look at the even images and the odd images. The average of those is, of course, the time series average. And the difference between the even and odds is what we call a noise average image. So here's the average image, and here's the noise average image, and you can take the standard deviation in here, and you can take the mean in here, and you can get a signal noise ratio. You can also compute the time series standard deviation, and you can get a signal to fluctuation noise ratio, or temporal SNR, which is the average image divided by the standard deviation. So that's this one. And so you can measure all these things on an automated fashion and use those as measures of quality. You can also look at something we call the Weisskopf analysis, and this was promulgated by Robert Weisskopf some years ago as a way of looking at scanner stability. So if you take a series of data and you look at the standard deviation as a function of the size of the ROI, with a small ROI, you're looking sort of at a voxel or two. And as you get larger and larger, if there is large-scale instabilities in the system, that is, the image is rocking back and forth because of spatial autocorrelation, then your standard deviation is not going to go down as you get to larger and larger voxels, larger and larger ROIs, as you would expect. So you would expect it to go down as the size of the ROI. The area is going to reduce the standard deviation if there's no spatial autocorrelation. But if there is, it's going to plateau. And so where the plateau meets this theoretical line is something we call the RDC, the radius of decorrelation. And so measuring that is important. So you see the measured standard deviation doesn't continue to go down, but it plateaus at some point because of scanner instability. So another way of characterizing scanner instability is to use this kind of a plot, and that's, again, something we do automatically. So you have a stability measurement, and here's one on our new scanner with 0.04. It's vastly stable. Nothing interesting in the spectral decomposition, which is always good, although at one point when we had a problem, we saw a big peak here that happened to be the shield cooler motor was crapping out. And the Weisskopf plot shows a pretty good characteristic, keeps going down. So if you have a database of this that you've acquired on your scanner, and here's about half a year of data on one of our systems, we have a pretty good idea where the stability is going to be, and occasionally things look bad, and so you know immediately that this thing is out of spec because you have that database, so it's very helpful. Sometimes you can, so once you know that, you can set specifications and so on for where you ought to be. And so here's, again, why we picked a particular spec in this case. So those kind of measurements can be very helpful in debugging problems in your scanner. Here's a case where it turned out that this kind of instability was due to bad gradient amps. Another case where the stability here was 0.62 turned out to be due to bad head coil. And again, you see this immediately, there's something wrong because the specs are way out of range. Looking at time series drift, things vary, but not a particularly interesting way. We also characterize the frequency drift of the scanner, things like that. And so in addition to stability, if you're doing DTI or other things, you care a lot about eddy currents because they can affect artifacts in particularly diffusion-weighted imaging in many directions. That's important. And so we do basically a phase contrast scan on a phantom. And if you get the phantom moving, that's probably bad for you. And the reason that it looks like it's moving is because eddy currents are looking like motion in some direction or another. So you can characterize that, and you can go badger your service engineer to fix things if the phantom looks like it's moving too much. And so you can set some specs for that. Well, so here was some stability plots from the scanners when we started back in 2003 for the scanners in the consortium. And they were kind of all over the map in terms of some looked pretty good and some looked pretty bad. And so when we started, things were pretty funky. All of these scanners were nominally within specs in terms of what the scanner manufacturers and their service guys thought, but they were totally different. And so our stability was all over the map. Most scanners were not stable by the comparisons that we later on set. And some of them were fine, but most of them needed some attention. And so I'm looking at drift. Some were well out of spec and some were not. Signal noise ratio and temporal signal noise ratio, again, were all over the map on different scanners doing ostensibly the same scans. And so what we did is we badgered the manufacturers and we said, well, you know, Mr. Siemens, your GE site across the street there could do this. How come you can't? And so as a function of time, these specifications, these measurements started to be pulled into a smaller and smaller budget in terms of fluctuation and drift because of the manufacturers being really embarrassed into it. But also just knowing that how you could measure this turned out to be valuable from the standpoint of assuring the quality of your scanners. And then again, this was one site. Things were bad, and they put in a new transmitter board, and then they put in a new RF amp, and things got better, and so on. Okay, so the QA program that we set up for this multi-site consortium had the initial results demonstrated that there was really a problem that was unsuspected in any of these sites. We set up a daily and weekly QA program that, in fact, has been ongoing and is highlighting problems that might otherwise go undetected. Especially when you're looking at trends, you may not know from one day to the next if this is really out of whack or not, or is it just something normal? And so these kinds of tests are very useful and have been going for some time. Okay, well, you've done everything you can to get your sites all as controlled as possible. Ultimately, there may remain some differences in across sites, and you may have to do something in your analysis in order to try to equalize them. So, in fact, we found these smoothness differences, and after a while, we tried to equalize those by changing the reconstruction algorithms, but we wanted to see whether we could control for the fact that there were different smoothness across sites. And we also wanted to see whether we could compensate by looking at the temporal signal noise ratio. Well, again, there was differences in smoothness across the different sites, and really fairly large, from 3.1 up to almost 4.5 or 5 millimeters of net resolution element size. And it turned out that totally was in agreement with the sensitivity in a bold task, in this case a sensory motor activation task that we used as a calibration. It was totally in agreement that with smoother sites, there was a greater percentage of variance accounted for in the time series data in that particular task. And there were, of course, differences between 3T versus 1.5T. That was expected, but even within a field of view, or a V-naught field, there were differences that were strikingly in concert with the resolution. So, in fact, if you plot that, you see that for the five subjects, they had different characteristic signals as a function of the resolution of the scanner, but there was a nice linear relationship. So we decided that maybe we could use some measure of the smoothness to smooth every site to a common value. That is, smooth each site to the largest field full width half max of the smoothest site in the consortium and see whether the group analysis was better or worse. And so we developed some software together with Bob Cox from at AFNI in order to do this automatically. And it's an iterative process because you have to measure the smoothness and then develop a filter and try it again. So when we were done doing this, in fact, we equalized GE and Siemens, which started out with a fairly large difference. We equalized within high and within low field between GE and Siemens. So we were able to remove site effects due to vendor, but we couldn't remove site effects due to field because that was really a different process. If we looked at the coefficient of variation across different sites, and we had, I think, 8 scans of the sensory motor task done over 2 visits in 2 different days, So we had a fair amount of data of these five subjects at 10 sites, scanned 8 times at each. So we could look at how reliable that was. And so without and with, and these are coefficients of variation at without smoothing, smooth 2 kind of a process, and with smoothing, the average over different brain regions in the sensory motor task. So the black shows a smaller coefficient of variation, both at 1.5T and at 3T, and substantial improvement in that. And also, if we looked at the effective field, we could reduce that substantially but we couldn't eliminate it, but we could reduce that coefficient of variation substantially, again, by using a smoothness correction. So if you looked at the difference between, in this case, just 4 of the sites in the consortium doing a sensory motor task, this is the oddball, auditory oddball task. You see this kind of activation pattern in the STG, and after equalization, there's substantially better agreement across these 4 sites. And in fact, one of these sites, which had a very high resolution and crummy bowl contrast noise ratio, we were able to get up to the same area as the others. Another part of the auditory oddball task, again, being able to substantially better equalize across these different sites, and once again. Okay, so another compensation approach that we attempted was to see whether we could use resting state signal-to-noise ratio as a way of predicting differences in sensitivity and compensating by that. So we measured the signal-to-fluctuation noise ratio using gray matter in a resting state scan, or using white matter in a resting state scan, or looking at the residual in a gray matter of a sensory motor task, or white matter in that same task, and then use that as a covariation and see whether regressing out differences that were observed in one of these 4 different ways of measuring signal-to-noise ratio, whether you could reduce site effects in that fashion. And so again, here's signal-to fluctuation noise ratio, which differed substantially across different sites with different field strengths and different vendors. So a factor of nearly 2 or more difference between the various sites in the consortium, just in this case, this is gray matter, what we call type 1 measurement of SFNR. Well, it turns out you can. So again, these are F tests. So these are significance between a covariation in sight before and after using this equalization. In fact, you can do a much better job after quantization than before. Also, we found that gray matter in a resting state scan was probably the best of these 4 measures. Anyway, there's a paper on that. Well, once you've done all of that, what else can you do? Well, in any kind of a study, you really, if you're trying to do neuroscience, you really care about the neurons, and you don't care much about BOLD. BOLD is an unfortunate sort of a consequence of things that you really care about. It's unfortunately confounded by the fact that hemodynamics is the mechanism by which you observe changes in neural metabolic processes. So maybe you want to try to calibrate out some of those changes, because that's good certainly at one site, but it's probably good for a multi-site study to try to remove some of those confounds as well. So what we call calibration here are trying to reduce subject-dependent changes in vasoreactivity that get in the way of your neural inferences. So the goals of a calibration process, as we define them for the FBurn, were to use tasks and traveling subjects to develop a way in which we might be able to characterize inter-site differences, but it turned out that we really cared more about inter-subject differences and develop mechanisms with which to try to reduce those variance components. And the ways that we did that were to use tasks that required minimal cognitive input and be robust, that people could do across the subject population, in particular, in this case, be performable by schizophrenic subjects. So we started using what we called our SM or sensory motor task, which I talked about before, but it was a flashing checkerboard together with annoying auditory tones and people tapping their fingers in concert with this 3 hertz activity. So it activates a large fraction of interesting things in the brain, such as auditory, motor, and visual regions of the brain, as well as some cerebellum. And so we hoped, because this was minimally cognitive, that it would be something that we could use as a way of calibrating across different sites. It turned out not to be the case. That is, even if we used a passive, in this case pneumatic plungers, to move fingers so that people didn't have to do anything, if they attended to this case a one-sided finger manipulation, you get signal that was pretty good in the sensory motor area. If you repeated it, it wasn't the same. And if you told them not to attend to the tapping on their fingers, in fact, they could pretty much eliminate that signal. So it turned out that this was not a very good task, and in fact, it turned out that schizophrenics had a lot of difficulty doing it anyway. So this was not a very good task for any kind of a calibration, and so we began to look at more hypercapnic kinds of challenges. Well, Davis and others have shown that if you look at the sequence of events by which hemodynamics changes, the bold signal is related to all kinds of things, including the change in CMRO2, the change in blood flow, and there's calibration constant here that people now like to call M, but it's something that is related to the vasoreactivity of the whole system. That is, how much does the arterioles side open up in response to a change in some chemical process, such as CO2 increase, NO changes, H plus changes, oxygenation concentration decreases, and so on. All of that vasoreactivity could be different across different subjects and across different regions in the brain. So it turns out that you can, if you make a measurement with, say, breath holding or hypercapnics, such as carbogen, you can get at that constant in a nice way. And so you can make a calibration that will try to eliminate that vasoreactivity component, or at least a fraction of it. And so we looked at using a breath hold task. In this case, breath holding is nice because it doesn't require a lot of manipulations other than having people hold their breath for 15 seconds. Lights up all of the vascular regions of the brain in ways that are regionally specific and are also subject specific. And so you can make a calibration then, which basically you take your measurement and you try to relate it to the metabolic processes that you care about by something that is a divisor, basically using the bold signal measured during the breath hold task. And if you do that, things get somewhat better. So here's just a working memory task without calibration across 7 different subjects. And you see quite large differences of people doing this task. If you calibrate them using a breath hold as a calibration, these are all adults, but we've also done it in children, you see a much better voxel-wise characterization or at least more uniform characterization of these bold signals. And if you enter that into a second level analysis, in fact, you get more activation. Because you've done that, you've removed some of the variance that we think is not very interesting to you as a cognitive neuroscientist, but more reflects local vasoreactivity and hemodynamics. So these calibration mechanisms can be utilized as a way of reducing some of the inter-subject variance that, in fact, will fold into multi-site and group analyses. And so you reduce the variance substantially by using these kinds of calibrations. We found it important, or at least useful, to control for the amount by which people inspire. So without biofeedback control, you get a certain residual here in a time series of the breath hold, and you can reduce that by telling people to inspire to a given level. So that's one approach. A second approach that we looked at is using arterial spin labeling to calculate, to measure the RCB off the blood flow. And this is one slide from Tom Liu, showing change in bold signal contrast as a function of resting state CBF. In fact, as the CBF goes up, the bold signal goes down. And so if people have different resting state CBF, you might expect substantial differences in their bold response doing a task. In fact, that's the case. And so we're looking at the use of ASL techniques as another way of trying to calibrate, remove some of the inter-subject differences. In fact, this also plays into things we talked about last night, which were confounds due to caffeine and other drugs, because it's known that caffeine can substantially change your bold signal, and it's because of this. It's because of the vasoreactive activity that caffeine and other chemicals can induce. So we use a Q2 QIPS kind of a pulse sequence across the different vendors to generate calibration data such as these RCBF maps. And I won't talk any further about that because of time, but one of the interesting things about calibration is that while you may control for subject differences because of their own vasoreactivity differences, that may ultimately decrease inter-site reliability, because as soon as you take out variance in one part of your equation, you might find that other inter-site variances becomes more and more important, and your ICC across sites may actually decrease by doing this. Nevertheless, you're doing the right thing. So we think that it's important to do this kind of calibration. Okay, well, a final thing is the performance of a study itself at a site is important. So once you've standardized your scanners and your parameters and all of that stuff, you also have to standardize everything else. You have to scan your button box, because different button boxes will change the reaction times. And so if you use performance measures as covariates in your analysis, that might be very, very important. Your audio-video equipment has to be very similar because of other confounds having to do with conspicuity of various parts of your visual presentation. If you're doing, as we were here, auditory things, then you care a lot about the auditory stimulus being uniform because, again, of the confounds of that. Things like byte bars to use, what kind of stimulus software you utilize, of course, is important. You need to standardize things like the order of the scans and control for those if you're trying to use cross-site changes. You need to have a script that tells that you follow when you're setting up your subject and preparing them. Slice prescription has to be uniform. You have to decide when you're going to do your QA scans relative to when you're doing these functional scans and so on. It's very important, we think, to use somebody that travels around all the sites and watches them and make sure that, in fact, they're doing these things, because, in fact, we found huge differences across people who think they're doing the same thing in terms of prescribing the AC-PC line. Some people had different views of where the AC and PC were. So things like that are important. And, of course, all the data analysis and processing is important to deal with properly. So just one example, when we measured the luminance across different sites, doing a gray contrast from over five values, there are very different curves for different sites, and some sites were orders of magnitude brighter than others, and so we had to control for that. So a lot of things are kind of important in this, and basically, in conclusion, you really want to standardize everything you can, because whatever you don't control for is later on going to bite you in some way. And you may not know what those are yet, and we certainly didn't when we started on this, and we know a lot more now about what to care about, for example, field strength. You need to compensate for the remaining inter-site differences, and there's a number of ways that one might look at doing that. And we think it's also important to use some kind of a calibration to diminish those kinds of things that will multiply when you get into a multi-site kind of a trial. So using some hypercapnic or ASL kind of a baseline. Well, this is a lot of work from a lot of people, and this is a subset of the group in the EFRIN that helped on it. Also, Laura Foland, who's now at UCLA, and Mariah Thomas and my kids were involved in this, and a few other people as well. So all this was funded by the NCRR, and we hope it will continue for a while. So I'll stop there and see if you have some questions.
So essentially you've shown that it's extremely difficult for people who are collaborating and trying to do the same thing to actually standardize parameters. So does this invalidate all meta-analyses across groups that are, you know, doing different paradigms, different procedures, different protocols, and trying to address the same, for example, cognitive process?
Yeah, well, I think if you saw a paper by Tor Wager on a meta-analysis of working memory, he had like 20 or 30 groups in there, and you see a cluster of points that a lot of them cluster in the same place, but yeah, I mean, what is one working memory group's task versus another's when not even the tasks are necessarily the same, but the scanners are not necessarily the same as well. So I think it's pretty hard so you have to read carefully what people did and how much they controlled for things, because a lot of these subtleties are simply not something you think about. You think about keeping the parameters as constant as possible, but you dig into the guts of the pulse sequence, and in fact, they can be very different. So I think, you know, we're starting to understand this. In the ADNI protocol, we spent a lot of time thinking about how to do a 3DT one-weighted scan, and it took manufacturers writing special ADNI pulse sequence in order to get it right across GE and Siemens, for example. So you have to read carefully when you're looking at a multi-site trial whether people actually did control for some of the things I talked about. In a couple of these studies we've been involved in, we've promulgated pulse sequences. So we've specified, use a GE scanner, and here's the pulse sequence that you use, and we compiled it here and we sent it out, for example. So we know exactly that things are as constant as possible.
Yeah. So one parameter I didn't see you addressing in this was T2 star, and I wonder if you've thought about ways to normalize shimming and whether you've measured T2 star in the brain, because I'm thinking about, for example, the intrinsic smoothness of the images, whether you're appetizing with a Gaussian or some other kernel.
Yeah, well, as I said, we eliminated the reconstruction kernel and across the sites to get rid of the reconstruction thing, but T2 star does change. And of course, it's important if you care about the frontal orbital and you're close to the dropout region, like amygdala or ventral medial prefrontal, the ways in which you shim are very important because of that. And so you can have huge differences, again, because of inter-site mores, and the way that people do their higher order shimming can be very important. Do you use a small region of interest or do you use a larger region of interest? In Yesburn, we developed a shimming protocol and a B-knot correction thing that we're using. So people take a shim scan, they do their shimming, but they also take a B-knot map, and we use that and later on to control for things. But yeah, T2 star is a big nuisance. So if you care about frontal orbital, so if you're an emotional or limbic type of person, then you do, and it's important to control for things like that. Okay.
So I was wondering if you have to summarize which parameters are really important to normalize and which are less important, because obviously that's one thing, into kind of other things that you want to standardize for. And maybe the second question is, all these comparisons were done on the same subjects, probably to different sites, but if you add the inter-subject variability between different subjects for each site, which parameter remains important?
Okay, first question. What was your first question? Probably the most important parameter to keep constant is the echoplanar resolution and contrast noise ratio. So spend some time thinking of measuring and caring about the resolution of your system, because that will have a major influence on any kind of bold sensitivity. So that's the first thing that's most important. And you don't assume that it's what you think it is. It's not 3.43 millimeters if you divide 220 by 64. The second, what was the second question? That's my brain
so
is.
The second question is if you had several different subjects at each
yeah,
size,
yeah. So
would you still see some differences between this formalization?
Well, of course. I mean, the whole point of this is not to measure five heavily controlled Stanford students or whatever. It's to enroll subjects with a whatever kind of demographic biodiversity there is and try to infer something about those subjects from a cognitive standpoint. So what happens when you put people in that are not as well trained as your normal controls is you get all the other things that you try to control for as much as possible, for example, by making sure that they know the task and they know the button box and they do all these things properly. You may have to control for differences in behavior. That's something we measure is, you know, reaction times and accuracy and all of that. And maybe you need to, you know, co-vary for those things as well. But, I mean, that's the point of it is to see if there are differences in your subject cohort. You know, they do whatever they want to do.
I just, thank you.